Please sign in by checking your name. Some of you were here last week and you didn't check your name. If I caught you, I did. Otherwise, please do that so it's accurate. Secondly, if you come in late, then make sure on the way out you do that. Third, not everybody is registered. So it's not everybody, not everybody that's on the, that is registered is on that list because the site was down yesterday when I was trying to print. So if you register by Wednesday, you're on the list. If you're registered and not on the list, write your name at the end of the list and put a check mark. So that when I reprint that thing yet again, I will have your name on the list. If you haven't registered, please go to the office after class and do that. Because I think they want you to register by today. I'm not sure that it closes today, but I think they do their counts at that point. If you know anybody that you want to take the class, they can still add, but they won't get on the official census. So do write, if you're not, again, if you're not on that list, but you are registered, write your name at the bottom. Let's see. I guess we're starting, huh? Okay, announcements. Mind Supermind, two Mind Superminds this term, one on February 27th, Jim Fadiman. One interesting thing I didn't tell you last week about Jim Fadiman is he's one of the founders of transpersonal psychology, and he co-founded the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. Wherever consciousness has been, since 1963 or something, Jim Fadiman has been in the middle of it. He's really an extraordinary guy. And what I'll have to say, well, I'm sure will be provocative because he specializes in provocative. So that's on February 27th. And then on May 8th, Rick Tarnas comes and talks about where humanity has been, where it is, and where it's going. In a way that only Rick Tarnas can talk about. Okay. So, Joe Bodrow's class on Zen and a Life Well Lived is tomorrow in this room. So there are flyers there. He's especially going to talk about how you deal with what's going on right now. How a person can be a Zen person at the same time be a social activist. That's tomorrow.
Another question. I'm asking, I don't have the money to pay for this class.
You go into the office and you ask him about that, Julie.
Okay.
Or you show up and plead your case, Joe. And I know what he'll say. I didn't say that, right?
What will they say?
He say fine.
Or just show up and don't say anything.
Just show up and see him. Okay, I didn't say that. Abraham's having, when's your poetry reading?
Sunday the 12th.
Of February. So there are flyers on the table about Abraham's poetry reading at Carpellis, right?
Carpellis.
And 2 o'clock. What?
2 o'clock in the afternoon.
At 2 o'clock on again, Sunday?
Sunday.
The 12th. And there are books that his latest book is there if you would like to buy one. See him or just put $13 on the table and take a book. Carl. This is Carl Blasius. Most of you know him. He's a member of the class. He's also an instructor at CLL. So Carl, say a little about your class, okay?
This is my third year of teaching some classes on biology and aging. Everything from psychology to molecular biology, focusing on the cells, which are the minimum sized life forms that we're all made of. 2 weeks from yesterday, that's on Thursday evenings, I'm having a class this semester on aging in the brain. The flyers are in the back. This is only two meetings. The idea of the administration was to make the class very affordable by only having two sessions. But I'm focusing on what I think is probably the most important area this time, and that is problems of dementia and loss of brain function as we get older. And there's new work coming out of a number of labs that's making pretty clear that there's a strong component of immune system dysfunction in loss of brain function, particularly due to Alzheimer's disease and related diseases. So we'll be covering that, focusing on that in these two sessions, including some of the science background, explaining how that's been discovered, and also varieties of treatments and preventive strategies that are being developed with some success. And it's a very exciting field for me. The brain is extremely complex, and we're learning every day how much more complex it is than we even think now. So some of you will join us.
Is it true that you're 165 years old?
Yeah. Only 102. And Spencer's 155.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Highly recommended. If you want the real science done in a user-friendly but authoritative way, Carl is a real resource. He really is. Okay. So first thing, what we do this morning is first we're going to meditate. Then it's going to be a didactically rich morning. I'm going to take you through a lot of important information. And then hopefully there'll be a little time to discuss the information, and I'd like to show you a video at the end, a good video at the end. So that's what we're going to do today. This class is about well-being in its various aspects, and everything we talk about today and each time will have to do with how to be well. Okay, so for those of you who weren't here last week's instruction was the Alpha and the Omega instruction of meditation, the first and the last instruction of mindfulness. There's various kinds of meditation. You can do any kind of meditation you like. Each of us will be doing a different meditation because each of us is slightly different. So what we hear will get filtered through who we are, and we will come up with our own meditation. By the way, while I'm thinking of this, because I get to go on tangents occasionally here, there's a guy named Irvin Yalom who actually came to Mind Supermind. Some of you might have seen him. He's one of the deans of the psychiatric community in the world. He works at Stanford. He wrote a book a few years ago called Letters to a Young Therapist, which is a wonderful little book, in which he said, I don't believe in standardized, manualized treatments that one size fits everybody, that you apply to everybody that comes to you. That's what they teach you in graduate school, but that's not what I believe. What I believe, he said, is that you invent a new psychology for each patient.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Who said that? This is Irvin Yalom, Y-A-L-O-M, who is a guy. You invent a new psychology for each patient. And I think what happens is each person is going to invent a new meditation for them suited for their personality.
I was going to say medications are being customized specifically for individuals now. So
That's the second iteration of medications and treatments is we individualize them, yeah.
What's the name of the book?
Letters to a Young Therapist.
Thank you.
Okay, so filter everything I say through who you are and what you need. So the first instruction, the simplest and the most profound instruction to me is just come back to your breathing. Don't try to do anything else. Don't try to suppress anything, make anything more, establishing a witnessing perspective. Don't do any of that. Just come back to your breathing over and over again to the physical feeling of your breathing. And what will happen is after a while, you'll be able to notice the physical feeling of your breathing and at the same time, notice the other stuff that's happening. You won't lose your breathing, you'll just notice that stuff. So the witness will emerge out of just paying attention to your breathing. If you try to establish a witnessing perspective, you will get sucked into a fancy thought. So that was the first thing I said. The second thing I said is, look, this isn't about your breathing. It's about softening and opening. It's about becoming larger and larger, more and more spacious, until ultimately you realize the unity of everything. So while you're paying attention to your breathing, you soften and open at every level that you perceive. But that was last week's instruction. Today's instruction follows, okay? It's not different than, it's beyond. Okay? So there are three levels of this instruction. first, most elementary level, can you clearly distinguish when you are present with your breathing and whatever's happening versus when you get lost in something, typically thought? You go away for a little bit and think, oh my God, I'm supposed to be sitting here meditating, come back to your breathing. Can you distinguish those two states, the state of absorption from the state of presence? Second level of that instruction, okay, so the first level is, can you distinguish getting being lost from coming back and staying present and being present? Second level of the instruction is, can you distinguish clearly thought from awareness itself? Typically, when people are first learning, even when they come to their breathing, thought comes with them. So it's like they're less absorbed because they're not away, but they're still, while they're feeling their breathing and noticing their sensations, they're still thought kind of clouding things. So it isn't so clear, the two states of absorption and presence. But as an intermediate meditator, it's very clear that thought is what goes on in your head, and presence is the awareness with which you move through the world. So can you clearly distinguish thought from awareness itself? Third level, most sophisticated level of this instruction is, can you stay present? Not keep getting lost in thought. How much can you be present? And what takes you, what compels you to not be present? It is said that when you're first beginning to learn mindfulness, it's very hard. It's very complicated. You don't do it very well. You're very frustrated. A lot of people give up. It's kind of like when you're crawling, learning to stand on your own two feet. It's too hard. You'd rather flop down. You think, oh man, standing on your own two feet, that's difficult. I can't master that, you know, when you're an infant. And then when you learn to walk on your own two feet, you think, why would I crawl? I mean, it's really hard to crawl. So the question is, why don't you just stay present? Why do you get lost in all this stuff that mostly doesn't do you any good and sometimes does you harm? What is the compulsion to crawl when you can walk? So what is the, how present can you stay and why don't you stay present all the time? That's the sophisticated instruction. Okay, that's enough elephant shit, as Chris Brooks used to say. Now let's sit and meditate, okay? 10 minutes. Bottom line, find your breathing, soften and open.
Thank you. the custodians to come and turn off both of the, turn them off completely, because I don't want to talk over the. Thank you. You can't find them, don't worry. Abraham, yeah.
The only way that I was able to come back to prison is by observing my breath. Did you mention anything else? No, that's the only
way. That's, well, no, it's not the only way, but it's something that's happening at present. So you can use anything happening at present. If you don't want to pay attention to your breathing, you can use hearing, because hearing keeps you here. Or any, you know, you can use your left little toe, but it's not very interesting. It's hard to stay aware. Anything else that keeps you present. It's just a technique for bringing you out of thought into presence. What I asked them to do is turn off the sound so I don't have to talk over the sound. Okay, so first of two topics. In these times of great concern and contention, I think it's important to mention again what I have mentioned to some of you before. When any human being is active in any way, that is all of us all the time, and when any two people are interacting, or when any two political parties are interacting, or when any two governments are interacting, or when any two cultures are interacting, or when any two countries are interacting, or when any two entities that are human, or fundamentally human, sort of, are interacting. It is important to remember this. We're not really choosing how we're acting. How we're acting is being chosen for us by our biological nature and our evolutionary history. We are merely choosing the strategies by which those motivations get satisfied. But the lower parts of our brain are creating the motives. So what that means, I'm going to tell you the motives in a minute, but what that means is everybody is coming from a place that they are not choosing, and that is a valid place. Because being alive means you have certain basic needs that motivate you through life. So anybody that you have contention with is coming from as valid a place as you are. Everybody's coming from these same places. So the discussion, is the disputes, the conflicts, shouldn't be conflicts in the sense that it's not about saying you're wrong and I'm right. Okay. What's really happening is everybody is expressing what they need to survive. And so that's always right. But the strategies are what you debate. How can you get your needs met and I get my needs met, and the most people get their needs met? What's the best strategy that will get each of us and all of us to the best possible outcome? So you're not, so you honor the person that you're, you know, the person you're disputing with. You say, look, I honor that you're coming from a valid place. I want to help you find what you need, but I need to be heard also, come from my valid place, and we need to talk about the strategy that creates a win-win situation. We need to keep talking until we find that strategy. So what are these basic needs that motivate you, me, all of us, all the time? I think there are four. The first of them is health and safety. We are motivated to stay alive. And so health and safety is a primary need that we have. And a lot of what's going on right now is people are not feeling safe. They're feeling like they're going to lose their job, their families are not going to be okay, they're going to get blown up. There's a lot of fear that is about health and safety that is motivating people to behave in certain ways that may not actually help them be healthy and safe. Second of the four basic needs, in my view, is the need for pleasure. Pleasure sounds like a frivolous thing. You know, what is this, a basic need? But pleasure is wired into our brains to show us what to approach and what to avoid. In nature, what's pleasurable gives you life. What's displeasurable you want to get away from because it takes life. The only human beings have invented stuff that is pleasurable that's not good for you. So we get addicted to things that aren't good for us, but that's a human phenomenon. In general, pleasure shows you where to go, and displeasure shows you where to go away from. So people need pleasure because first it motivates them to go in the right direction for increasing their life, and secondly, it'll come back. All right, so that's the second letter. The second of the four basic needs is pleasure. People that don't have any pleasure in life are not creating a life that's good for them. And it's not only that the consequences are that they don't feel pleasure, it's that not feeling pleasure doesn't motivate them in the right direction in the first place. So pleasure is important. If you don't have any pleasure in your life, you're not increasing your life. Third of the four basic motives is the motive to have a self, to have an identity. Now, why is that important? Well, if you don't have a sense of self, then you can't read what the self needs. You can't relate to if you're not sure of yourself, if you don't know where to go to find yourself, then you don't know what the self is asking for. So I think the self need has three components to it: identity, autonomy, and ability. That is, you need to have a sense of who you are, okay, an accurate sense of who you are. You have to be able to read yourself and like yourself. Second, you have to be able to, autonomy, you have to be able to make choices to increase your aliveness. You have to have the freedom to choose how to go. And third, you have to have the ability to get what you need. So the self need is about identity, autonomy, ability. But if you want to encapsulate that all, it's having a sense of self. And a lot of what people dispute about, especially in marital situations, is one of the two people says, "You don't let me be myself." Maybe 30 years ago, what's his name? Jesse Jackson filled the LA Coliseum with people chanting, "I am somebody, I am somebody, I am somebody." Why? Because those were people that were invisible. Those were basically minority people who felt like they nobody saw them, they didn't count, they didn't have an identity. That's why kids tag. You realize tagging is such a big thing, because kids are saying, in the midst of these 7 billion people and all this stuff going on, "I'm somebody." So it's a basic need that we have for a sense of self. And I could go on at great length about what that, I probably will at some point, about what the self feels like, why it doesn't develop fully, and how to develop it better. Okay, third of the four needs is self. Fourth of the four needs is connection. We don't survive and thrive alone. We are a group species. We have a long evolutionary history of depending on one another, of interacting with one another, or supporting one another. We need connection. So people are motivated at any point. You're motivated by one or more of the four of these things. These are what move you through life. So there's nothing wrong with wanting health and safety, pleasure, identity, and connection. There's nothing, nobody that you're have issue with is wrong about that. That's what's motivating them. But what you have to talk to them about is, what's the best way to get your needs and my needs and all of our needs met? Does that make sense to people? So you have to honor the people that you have issue with. And at the same time, you have to deal with those issues. Which is what's wrong with the world right now, is because people are saying, I'm right and you're wrong, you're illegitimate and I'm legitimate. That creates more polarization, more misunderstanding, more dysfunction, which we're seeing increase. Now, as for these four needs, are these four needs the four basic needs? So after I kind of puzzled this for myself, I thought, well, who's talked about this? Well, Abe Maslow did, right, in the hierarchy of needs that we all had to study. What is his hierarchy of needs? Bottom level is health, physiological need, you know. Second, biological need. Second level of need is safety for him, so he separated them out. I put them together, they're basically the same thing. He called them those physiological needs anyway. So the first two needs in his pyramid of needs, his hierarchy of needs, are health and safety. And then he talked about love and belongingness and esteem, identity. So those were his four needs. And the top one, self-actualization, is not a need in the same sense. It's a different kind of need. It's a need that grows out of having satisfied these basic needs. It's something that's an overtone or that comes out of the basic needs. So he mentioned three of the four. Okay, in his first four levels, he mentioned health, safety, connectedness, and identity. He left out pleasure, which is interesting. But pleasure got a bad rap for much of the time in the intellectual 20th century. I think it's curious that he did leave that out. But he basically verifies what I had thought. So then I went to an even better system than any that the West has ever cooked up. I went to the chakra system, which we've talked about, most of us. And what are the first four chakras? First chakra, survival, health and safety. Second chakra, pleasure. Third chakra, identity. Fourth chakra, connection. And the fifth, sixth, and seventh chakras are combinations and overtones of those first four. So the Hindus, thousands of years ago, said exactly that same thing, that these are the basic motives of a human being. So that's all I want to say about this. I just want you to remember, when you're thinking about those folks who distress you and that stuff that's happening, that they're human too, and they're motivated fundamentally by something they don't choose that is fundamentally right for a human being. So you have to kind of have a humility about how you go about trying to change the world. You can't have an inflated sense that I'm right and you're wrong, because that would be wrong. Okay, so a couple of comments. So first of all, Michael and then Susan, right?
What you're describing with needs and strategies almost sounds verbatim like Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication.
Yeah, of course.
That if you're interested in learning more about that, observations, feelings, needs, strategies, and requests, Roger Sorrow is teaching a class he does every quarter here at the SHOT on nonviolent communication. So it's a great way to practice.
Yeah, NVC is a way to learn to express your needs in a clear and compelling fashion, and how to deal with disputes by going to needs and realizing the validity of them, and then talking about how to satisfy all the sets of needs. Yeah, NVC is very parallel to this. It's a little different about how he identifies a lot more needs, and I have a kind of more condensed system. Susan.
I think it's wonderful you're discussing things in this way, especially in these times, so that each of us, as we go forward, or thinking, or speaking, or acting, are bringing more light and peace to the situation instead of behaving like we're accusing the others. But I just bring up something. I know you're probably not saying this, but it sounds a bit as though there is that ethics and morals are just a matter of perspective.
No, I hadn't thought about it, but ethics and morals are a matter of what everyone needs. So there are things that are, we call moral. Okay, there's a guy named John Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, who some of you know about, who's the preeminent moral psychologist in the world today. He says our morality comes from our evolutionary history. The things that we think are good, and that everybody thinks are good, come from the need of the organism to survive and procreate. And he delineates six six basic moral stances that everyone has because of their biology. So it's not a question of relativity, it's a question of these things are wired into us. They create what we call good and not good. Okay? What's relative is how you deal with those things, how you satisfy those needs. But our ethics and morals are in his view anyway, and in my view, are the reason that everybody is so passionate about these things is because they have to do with life itself. They're basically biological.
If you know that somebody agrees with you, but they're going for the making money rather than dealing with...
Then you talk to them about it. Then when they come into therapy and they say to me, well, I made so much money, but I can't stop making money. What's, you know, and I'm not very happy. I should be super happy. I have all this stuff, but what's wrong with me? What we talk about is, you know, why? What's the compulsion to make money? What's underneath that compulsion? Underneath all these nasty things are valid, unmet needs. A person that doesn't feel safe needs to have all the stuff in the world between them and mortality. You know, who doesn't, or a person who doesn't feel good about herself has to have all the best to convince herself that she's okay. So under, you know, the person who feels superior is always underneath feeling inferior. You know? So you have to, you look beyond the surface and you have compassion for people that you otherwise would have disdain for or hatred for. Okay, so Abraham, and then we got to move because this is just I've just scratched the surface. This is just the beginning. I got a major thing to talk to you about.
Please tell me what's the need of a person that comes to you and says, I'm glad we got rid of that monkey.
Yeah.
Got rid of that
monkey. A monkey being a bad person or something? Okay. That's a person who feels threatened, who feels scared that people unlike him will hurt him or his family. He's coming from fear. People come from fear, and that's what causes hatred. You realize that anger comes from being threatened, and hatred comes from being terrified. You hate that which has the most, you feel is has the most inimical force that could hurt you the most. So when you feel hatred, you say, wow, what's going on underneath that? What? How threatened do I feel? Is that valid? What's going on? You know, it would cause me to have that feeling come out of me. Okay, so understand? So it's not that you like that person. You have to talk to that person about what they need and how they can get it in a way that doesn't create a worse world, a world that replicates their defensive strategy. Okay, we can say a lot more about this, but let's leave it, okay? Because I want to talk to you about your life, okay? I always talk to you about that. I want to talk to you about... the best roadmap we have of a life course. Some of you know about this, so it'll be review. Others of you don't know a lot about this. I'll tell you a tiny bit, and I'll give you this so that you can follow right along and take it with you. Okay, so this is the work of Erik Erikson. Okay. Erik Erikson was born in 1902 in Denmark. As a youth, he rambled around Europe as a bohemian. He did art. And somehow he stumbled onto Anna Freud, Sigmund Freud's daughter, who psychoanalyzed him. And he became very interested in psychology. And then, because he was half Jewish, he had to flee Europe when the Nazis came to power, came to the United States, and starting about 1950, he published a theory about how life goes that is still the preeminent roadmap in developmental psychology about the life course. So having said that, let's take a look at the 8 stages of life according to Erik Erikson and how at each stage there's a developmental crisis, a challenge. And depending on how that crisis is met, it creates the possibility for the rest of your life. So it's like building a skyscraper, like an 8-story building. If the foundation is shaky, the whole rest of the building is shaky. If the third floor is not built well, then the floors above it aren't in good shape. So it's necessary to surmount each crisis well in order to build a strong and fulfilled life. Now, the criticism of this is that it isn't so distinctly stage-like. It's more gradual, and these things kind of get mixed up together. That's a valid criticism. But still, as a first approximation, this stage theory does well. Okay. So what this is going to bring up for you is, how did I do with these stages, and how can I do some repair work when I need to do some repair work? And that's a topic that we'll talk about. But first, let's go through the roadmap, okay? So I need to, each of you gets one of these. You don't need to memorize it now. We're going through it. Anita, will you help me by, okay, so, Michael, yeah? Okay, so, and what I would do is, why don't you give me half of those, and I'll start from the back. Spread them around. I have more than enough. It's only one front and back. It's only front and back, yeah. Probably should be some more. If there are extras, give them back to me. They probably got them over there. Here. So extras come back up here so that we can. Okay. So. These two pages from Chris Peterson's book, A Primer in Social Psychology. A Primer of Positive Psychology. Okay. 2006, A Primer of Positive Psychology, Christopher Peterson. These are the two pages where he talked about Erickson's theory. Erickson's theory appears in every psychology. It's amazing. I mean, after 70 years, it's still well thought of. So let's go through it. Okay. The penciled in, the handwritten stuff, that's my way of talking about it. Erickson's way of talking about it is in italics. So first level.
Wait, I'm sorry, this is from what book?
This is from a primer. A Primer in Positive Psychology, too.
Who's the author?
Christopher Peterson. Peterson. With an A, with an O. Peter's son. Okay, so, this is a psychosocial theory of development. That is, it talks about how human beings become more socialized. Sigmund Freud's theory of development, which preceded this, was a psychosexual theory about sexual maturation. And because survival and procreation is so central biologically, this is a more social theory. Okay, trust versus mistrust. The child is just born. Well, no, let's go back a little further. The child is being carried in the womb. Is that a good womb or a so-called good womb or bad womb? That is the child in an environment which is nurturing? Is the mother secure about carrying the child? Or does the child experience noxious elements like alcohol or tobacco or drugs or other bad environmental toxins coming in and polluting the intrauterine atmosphere? Is the mother anxious? So the question is, even in the womb, is the child getting the message that it's okay or it's not okay? And then there's the birth process itself. The birth trauma, is the birth reasonably good birth? Or does the child come out with a lot of complication? In which case, the first thing the child learns about the world that she or he is coming into is it's life-threatening. And then there's very early childhood. The child cries, and no one's there because mom is drunk. You know, or the child cries and no one's there because mom isn't there for some reason. Or the child cries and no one comes to comfort and feed because the child is not supposed to be fed except every 4 hours on the schedule. You know. So and a little later in life, the child hurts her himself or needs to be changed or something, and no one comes to attend. So the child learns very early, at a very pre-verbal level, either the world is safe or it's not safe. When you express your needs, when you go, the world listens and meets your needs, or the world does not meet your needs. This is wired into us at an incredibly primitive pre-verbal level. So you learn basic trust or basic mistrust. The world is safe or it's not safe at this level. So this underlies the higher octaves of anxiety that we experience. But the basic anxiety is it's not okay to be alive. It's not safe to be alive, or it is. So the developmental crisis is to learn to have basic trust, to build a strong foundation for the rest of your life, or not, or to have a strong foundation in place. If you don't have basic, we'll talk at some point about how you repair damage at this deep level. It's the most challenging of the psychological repairs to be done, but it can be done. But it generally involves kind of rebirth, you know. And sometimes that involves a changing of the entire life situation, so that you're in a much more secure life situation and you're surrounded by people that care about you as opposed to don't care about you. Sometimes it involves a spiritual opening to a larger sense of security. The metaphor I use is for a plant. When a plant is not doing well, sometimes it isn't enough to water it and put fertilizer. Sometimes you have to transplant that thing. You have to put it in an entirely different environment, and then it thrives. Some people need physical transplantation. Some people need psychological transplantation. But it's at that deep level of life and death. These people need this stuff. All right. Second of these 8 stages of development, Erickson called autonomy versus self-doubt. I call it can, can't, able, unable, or succeed, fail. So this is Erickson talked particularly about toilet training about a year and a half or so. What he said was, because toilet training supposedly is the first major activity that the child has to master. Previous to this, the needs are satisfied. When the child needs something, it cries or what, it makes noise, and the need is satisfied. In other words, the child doesn't have to do anything to get his or her needs met except express the need.
That's now, before walking.
What?
That's before walking?
No, it's not. So there are several things in this realm. I'm just going to talk about toilet training as being kind of the most emphasized in psychology, the most major. The child has to learn to control him or herself. Some of us are toilet trained in a gentle, affirming way, and others of us are berated for, oh, you did it again, you can't. And so the child either learns, I can master this, or the child learns, I'm not good enough. I can't do this. I'm not good enough. Another example. Let's say the child is like a year just walking and has seen mommy and daddy put dishes in the dishwasher. And now the child is kind of like taking the dish and putting it in the dishwasher, and mommy and daddy, somebody comes in and sees that. What do they say? Do they say, oh, that's so cute. Be careful, I'll help you with this. Yeah, that's exactly what we do. Or do they say, oh my God, you're going to hurt yourself, you're going to break that dish, stop. In which case, the child learns, I can't. I'm not good enough. I'm not equal to it. So through the process of learning to walk, too, either you, when you flop down and you get up again, they say, hey, you're doing fine. You know, it's good. That's how you do it. Or they say, you can't do that. Or be careful. You hurt your, you know. They either give you messages that you're capable or not capable. And these things are pretty verbal. Okay? These are way early. You either learn you can do stuff in the world or you can't do stuff in the world. Peg? What?
Is that where shame comes in?
That's where, yes. So shame comes in before guilt. You know, guilt and shame are the real early ones. Shame comes in. Shame is about who you are, right? Guilt is about what you do. Shame is about who you are. So shame is that I am not equal to, I am not good enough. It's about you. I am not. Is shame. So it comes in way, way early. Something wrong with me. What do I want to say about this?
You were saying about being capable or not.
Yeah, but there was something else I wanted to say that was flashing through my mind, but I don't remember what it was. Let me think for a second. Oh, yeah. I have always wondered why it is that some people have so much chutzpah that they think that they can go in their garage. I actually worked with a guy at MIT who got an idea, quit school in his sophomore year, and borrowed 10 grand from his grandfather, and in his garage in Massachusetts, he started a company. And I would have thought, are you kidding? You're throwing away my education, your 10 grand you're going to throw away on something that's going to go nowhere? I mean, you're an idiot. But he actually, I worked with him for several years. He made so much money. And he made me a college education and more because we were people that started Computer Day. It was started at Harvard and MIT, basically contemporaneously. And we were the MIT wing of it. And it became a national phenomenon. It preceded all the Match.com stuff. Now it was a real big deal. And why did he have the trust to do that? Why did he think that it would work out? Why did Steve Jobs in somebody's garage make a computer and think, I'm going to make something that people are actually going to buy? How do people that are entrepreneurs take these extremely stupid risks and make them into what? How does Elon Musk think up stuff and then does this stuff? I mean, what kind of person is wired that way? Somebody who very early in their life learned they can. Whatever they can think of, they can create. Like more of that, Gene. okay. So now we're moving to the third stage. Now we're at, let's say you're 5 years old now. So we're moving, we're aging now. We're 5 years old, and it's mommy's birthday. And mommy's off at work. So I think that I'm going to go into the kitchen and I'm going to make mommy a cake, because I've watched mommy make a cake before. So I walk into the kitchen and I start taking stuff out. And mommy comes home after a day at work, and she comes into the kitchen and she sees milk on the floor, and she sees dough on the ceiling, and she sees everything, you know, because I'm like, and she sees me covered with nameless things. And what does she say? Does she say, oh, that's so cute, that's so adorable. Let's make the cake together. You're so considerate of me. Let's clean you off, and let's clean off the floor, let's clean off the fan, and let's clean off the ceiling. And yeah, that's good. Or does she say, oh my God, it's my birthday, I work so hard today, I come home, and now this, you've created this mess for me, how could you do this? Do you learn that when you take initiative, it is appreciated? Or do you learn that whenever you do something, you screw up and it creates difficulty for other people, so you feel guilty all the time every time you try to do anything? Do you learn basically that you are good or bad? very early age, kids are learning this, that when they do stuff, it works out, or when they do stuff, it creates misery for other people, it creates problems for other people. How could you do this to me? Okay, so flip it over. Now we're in school. And we are learning our ABCs. We're no longer learning to write, because they don't do that anymore. So we're learning to go like this. We're learning we're learning to play an instrument or sing. Now they don't do that anymore, or draw. But we're out on the sports field learning to play sports. Do we see that we can learn our ABCs and our 1-2-3s? Do we see that we can kick the ball? Or do we see we're not as good as the other kids? This is competence versus inferiority. Equal to or less than. Do we learn that we're equal to life, or that we're not good as other people about the things of life? Now, before we get too smug about this, you realize that they start giving grades in first grade, right? And some people get A. It used to be E, G, whatever it was, already we are telling most of the children that are going through these early grades that they're not quite as good as the best. So we're already giving kids the idea that I'm second level, or I'm third level, or I'm not equal to, or I'm not able to. So this idea of grading kids does a huge disservice at all levels of education, it seems to me. What we ought to be doing for all our kids is saying, yeah, some people can progress quicker in one way than another, but everybody can progress. This is a growth model as opposed to the fixed model that Carol Dweck talks about. But a lot of kids learn that they're inferior at some basic level, and it screws up their whole lives.
I think it's an extra danger when the curve is used. It can be helpful maybe to perform better, but also worse, but you're also adding a component of competition directly with the other people.
Yeah, and so what that means is a lot of people are going to get the idea that they lost. Okay, so that's very early education. Your kids are already learning that they're going to succeed in life and they're not going to succeed in life. Sorry. Okay, then come the teenage years. In the teenage years, the teenage years start out by kids trying to reestablish an identity from my parents' little kid to part of the group. They change their focus from their parents to their peers. And in the beginning of the teenage years, you notice that all the kids try to do the same thing. They all try to say the same thing, walk in the same way, wear the same clothes, watch the same programs, do the same social media stuff, so that they feel like they're one with their peers. They're approved of by their peers. They're like little clones. By the end of the teenage years, you're supposed to be a unique individual, not somebody who is dependent on the opinions of your peers, but is who you are. Of course, that doesn't happen, so developmental psychology has invented 5 more years, from 20 to 25, called emerging adulthood, to give you 5 more years to find out who you are. But of course, that doesn't happen, and in California especially, you find people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s who are trying to be cool. What's the cool thing? Let me do the cool thing. See me? That's a person that doesn't have a unique sense of self, doesn't have a strong sense of self, but is dependent on, is looking for what is socially approved to make them feel better about who they aren't. So this is supposed to happen in adolescence. You're supposed to develop a unique, strong identity. Or else you have role confusion, you don't know who you are. I call this self, lack of self. And most of you heard the expression, You can't share a self or give a self if you don't have a self, right? That may explain why there's some difficulty in romantic relationships thereafter, because people don't have a strong identity with which to negotiate the intricacies of relationship. So, now we go into our 20s, and the task of young adulthood is supposed to be to become intimate. That is, to broaden out the self-focus, which is so much a part of childhood and teenage years, to include another person, other people, so that you are more, you become more connected and in deeper, more profound ways. So, supposedly in the early adulthood, you're supposed to establish intimacy. You're supposed to find people to be deep friends with, to love, to start a family with, to join with. If you don't, you already start, and I see this in a lot of the kids that I teach at City College. Already they're starting to feel like something's wrong with them because they can't find a boyfriend or girlfriend. They can't, everybody else is kind of like pairing up, they see everybody else pairing up, it's not true. And they feel like they're kind of getting left behind. And by the time they get to their late 20s or early 30s, they pack. Am I never going to find intimacy? That's a good question to ask, because why haven't they by that point? So I call this love, no love. And it's critical in the early adulthood years to establish these bridges. Otherwise, throughout life, there's an increasing sense of being isolated. Okay. Then in middle adulthood, he calls it generativity versus stagnation. You're supposed to expand your self-definition to include your family, your community, your friends, the ideals that you stand for, so that your energies aren't self-focused so much as focused on other people and causes that are important to you. You're supposed to become a bigger person, okay, a more inclusive person. You're supposed to be generative. You're supposed to give energy to the world. You're supposed to nurture the world. Okay. Or stagnation means you kind of, at some deep level, get bored or dissatisfied, and you decide, well, maybe what I need is a Porsche. You know? That'll make me feel, or maybe what I need is a castle, you know, or maybe I need whatever, you know. And because there's a deep feeling of something gone wrong. Even though there might be material success, there's a feeling that there's an emptiness where there should be the fullness of these relationships. And so you try to make up for that emptiness by filling your shopping cart. And then that leads to the last stage of life, the older adulthood, where there's either a sense of ego integrity, that is, what a life I have created, what a beautiful thing I have made, what a fulfillment I feel, versus despair. I wish I could do it again. I blew it. You know, I didn't do it right. I made the wrong decisions. I don't feel good. So I call this contentment or regret. So that's Erickson's little map of how life develops, either for the better or the not so well better. I think what I want to do in the next 7 minutes, while I set up the video, it's going to take 11 minutes, is why don't you turn to your neighbor? Like three people, clump up in about groups of three and quietly react to what I said about basic needs or what you just heard. You don't have to spill your beans. You don't have to say, oh my God. But you might say, you know, something that particularly, what particularly of anything that just got discussed, what particularly moves in you? So quietly turn to your neighbor, and for a few minutes, you get a chance to give voice. Okay.
stop to ring the bells and expect me to kind of like cut up your,
especially important topic. But I have to kind of fit everything in. So this is something you might want to talk about a little more.
Yeah, we did not follow the pattern. We did our own thing from the earliest days.
Okay.
Yeah, and felt responsible for the community and all from the earliest.
For the earliest days. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to necessarily go in this stage-wise fashion. Okay. The thing I wanted to tell you because of what came up in our group is Maslow said a lot of cool stuff. So what Maslow said is that at various points in life, it's clear that there's a choice. There's two voices in you, and one is saying one thing, and the other is saying another thing. Should I learn to paint? No, you really have been lousy at art all your life, it'll just be wasted money and time. You know, there are two voices that have come back and forth. Maslow said, when there are those two voices, which one do you trust? Do you take the growth choice, or do you take the fear choice? Simple as that. Which is the growth choice? Which is the fear choice? Growth choice leads to more, fear choice leads to less. I hate that saying, it has goaded me into taking a lot of risks. Okay, now I'm going to show you an 11-minute video by Laura Carstensen, who is the director of the Stanford Longevity Center. Remarkable person. Doing remarkable work. So this is some good news for you, okay? After the sobering, semi-sobering news that some of you may have just received. This is Laura Carstensen. Carstensen, you'll see her name when I Google it, right? I mean, when I search it.
Societies are getting greater. You hear about it all the time. You read about it in your newspapers, you hear about it on your television sets. Sometimes I'm concerned that we hear about it so much that we've come to accept longer lives with a kind of a complacency, even ease. But make no mistake, longer lives can, and I believe will, improve quality of life at all ages. Now, to put this in perspective, let me just zoom out for a minute. More years were added to average life expectancy in the 20th century than all years added across all prior millennia of human evolution combined. In a blink of an eye, we nearly double the length of time that we're living. So if you ever feel like you don't have this aging thing quite pegged, don't kid yourself. It's brand new. And because fertility rates fell across that very same period that life expectancy was going up, that pyramid that has always represented the distribution of age in the population, with many young ones at the bottom, winnowed to a tiny peak of older people who make it and survive to old age, is being reshaped into a rectangle. And now, if you're the kind of person who can get chills from population statistics, these are the ones that should do it, because what that means is that for the first time in the history of the species, the majority of babies born in the developed world are having the opportunity to grow old. How did this happen? Well, we're no genetically hardier than our ancestors were 10,000 years ago. This increase in life expectancy is the remarkable product of culture, the crucible that holds science and technology and wide-scale changes in behavior that improve health and well-being. Through cultural changes, our ancestors largely eliminated early death so that people can now live out their full lives. Now, there are problems associated with aging. Diseases, poverty, loss of social status, it's hardly time to rest on our laurels. But the more we learn about aging, the clearer it becomes that a sweeping downward course is grossly inaccurate. Aging brings some rather remarkable improvements, increased knowledge, expertise, and emotional aspects of life improve. That's right. Older people are happy. They are happier than middle-aged people, and younger people, certainly. Study after study is coming to the same conclusion. The CDC recently conducted a survey where they asked respondents simply to tell them whether they experienced significant psychological distress in the previous week, and fewer older people answered affirmatively to that question than middle-aged people, and younger people as well. And a recent Gallup poll asked participants how much stress and worry and anger they had experienced the previous day. And stress, worry, anger, all decreased with age. Now, social scientists call this the paradox of aging. I mean, after all, aging is not a piece of cake. So we've asked all sorts of questions to see if we could undo this finding. We've asked whether it may be that the current generations of older people are and always have been the greatest generations. That is, that younger people today may not typically experience these improvements as they grow older. We've asked, well, maybe older people are just trying to put a positive spin on an otherwise depressing existence. But the more we've tried to disavow this finding, the more evidence we find to support it. Years ago, my colleagues and I embarked on a study where we followed the same group of people over a 10-year period. Originally, the sample was aged 18 to 94. And we studied whether and how their emotional experiences changed as they grew older. Our participants would carry electronic pagers for a week at a time, and we'd page them throughout the day and evenings at random times, and every time we paged them, we'd ask them to answer several questions on a 1 to 7 scale. How happy are you right now? How sad are you right now? How frustrated are you right now? So that we could get a sense of the kinds of emotions and feelings they were having in their day-to-day lives. And using this intense study of individuals, we find that it's not one particular generation that's doing better than the others, but the same individuals over time come to report relatively greater positive experience. Now you see the slight downturn at very advanced ages, and there is a slight downturn, but at no point does it return to the levels we see in early adulthood. Now, it's really too simplistic to say that older people are happy. In our study, they are more positive, but they're also more likely than younger people to experience mixed emotions. Sadness at the same time you experience happiness. You know, that tear in the eye when you're smiling at a friend. And other research has shown that older people seem to engage with sadness more comfortably and more accepting of sadness than younger people are. And we suspect that this may help to explain why older people are better than younger people at solving hotly charged emotional conflicts and debates. Older people can view injustice with compassion, but not despair. And all things being equal, older people direct their cognitive resources, like attention and memory, to positive information more than negative. If we show older, middle-aged, younger people images, like the ones you see on the screen, and we later ask them to recall all the images that they can, older people, but not younger people, remember more positive images than negative images. We've asked older and younger people to view faces in laboratory studies, some frowning, some smiling. Older people look toward the smiling faces and away from the frowning, angry faces. In day-to-day life, this translates into greater enjoyment and satisfaction. But as social scientists, we continue to ask about possible alternatives. We've said, well, maybe older people report more positive Emotions because they're cognitively impaired. We said, could it be that positive emotions are simply easier to process than negative emotions? And so you switch to the positive emotions. Maybe our neural centers in our brain are degraded such that we're unable to process negative emotions anymore. But that's not the case. The most mentally sharp older adults are the ones who show this positivity effect the most. And under conditions where it really matters, older people do process the negative information just as well as the positive information. So how can this be? Well, in our research, we found that these changes are grounded fundamentally in the uniquely human ability to monitor time. Not just clock time and calendar time, but lifetime. And if there's a paradox of aging, it's that recognizing that we won't live forever changes our perspective on life in positive ways. When time horizons are long and nebulous, as they typically are in youth, people are constantly preparing, trying to soak up all the information they possibly can, taking risks, exploring. We might spend time with people we don't even like because it's somehow interesting. You know, we might learn something unexpected. We go on blind dates. You know, after all, if it doesn't work out, there's always tomorrow. People over 50 don't go on blind dates. As we age, our time horizons grow shorter and our goals change. When we recognize that we don't have all the time in the world, we see our priorities most clearly. We take less notice of trivial matters. We savor life. We're more appreciative. We're open to reconciliation. We invest in more emotionally important parts of life, and life gets better. So we're happier day to day. But that same shift in perspective leads us to have less tolerance than ever for injustice. By 2015, there will be more people in the United States over the age of 60 than under 15. What will happen to societies that are top-heavy with older people? The numbers won't determine the outcome. Culture will. If we invest in science and technology and find solutions for the real problems that older people face, and we capitalize on the very real strengths of older people, then added years of life can dramatically improve quality of life at all ages. Societies with millions of talented, emotionally stable citizens who are healthier and better educated than any generations before them, armed with knowledge about the practical matters of life and motivated to solve the big issues, can be better societies than we have ever known. My father, who is 92, likes to say, "Let's stop talking only about how to save the old folks and start talking about how to get them to save us all."
All right, so I'm going to turn the light just a second. So I think I will, as Laura Carstensen, we published a lot. I think I'll end with a quote from Margaret Mead that many of you know, but it echoes what she just said. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Okay, Marty,
quick comment. How about that group having good aims and being able to out to destroy rather than build?
Well, what she talked about is a group of thoughtful. Not more. Okay.
see you next week, folks. Have a great week.